Hi, I'm Sam Dingman, co-host of The Show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what an investigation into Medicaid fraud found 3 years after a major scandal.
And a new solo show about how growing up in a home without secrets makes you want to share yours publicly.
But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
This is a really big win, and I want everyone to feel proud of it because Kristi Noem has done so much damage to this country as ICE has terrorized communities across the United States.
American service members, they've lost their lives because of this administration's decision to strike Iran. And Congress was never even consulted about this, not once. That's not how this is supposed to work.
Everybody has a plan until they get punched in the mouth. And as somebody who's gone to war many times, I can tell you that often, you know, things don't go the way that you planned, and you've got to be able to be flexible.
This is such a distraction. America is hurting right now. I talk to Arizonans all the time. They can't buy a house. Rent is getting expensive. Food's expensive. And what are we doing? We're spending billions of dollars on a war of choice.
Water security for Arizona is national security. We also want to make clear that if Arizona is forced to take disproportionate cuts, it doesn't just affect Arizona, it affects all of the country.
It doesn't cost less to feed kids in Arizona. Transportation, it doesn't cost less to run their buses, and you need to have bus drivers and fuel. The APSs doesn't give schools less of a break on their utility costs.
And joining me to talk about what the change at the Department of Homeland Security might mean for Arizona, competing plans for increased transparency in state government, and more are Christina Corrieri of Consilium Consulting. Good morning, Christina.
Morning, Mark.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Christina, let me start with you. Kristi Noem is out as the Secretary of Homeland Security. Oklahoma Senator Mark Wayne Mullen is set to be at least go through the confirmation process. There's no indication that he's going to have any trouble being confirmed to be the new head of Homeland Security. There's obviously been so much talk about, is ICE coming to Phoenix or Tucson? Might they come for elections? Any sense of what a change at the top and the sort of the circumstances that surrounded it might mean for Arizona?
Well, I think with the circumstances surrounding it, no president wants a cabinet secretary that's in the headlines for all the wrong reasons. And I think the $220 million ad campaign that Kristi Noem ran as Secretary of Homeland Security that drew questions really from both sides of the aisle, it looked more like a vanity play than a proper use of taxpayer dollars, was that last straw. In terms of confirmation for Senator Mullen, I think senators always have a leg up. That's their colleagues. They know them. So I don't expect a strong challenge there to his confirmation process in the Senate. I don't think that his appointment is going to change anything in terms of the direction that this administration wants to go in terms of making sure that immigration law is enforced and that people who are not authorized to be in the country go through the process of removal.
Tony, would you agree that it sounds like, Christina, what you're saying is that if ICE was going to come to Phoenix under Kristi Noem, they're probably still going to come under future Secretary Mullen. Is that a fair assessment?
I think that's a fair assessment.
Do you agree with that, Tony?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think that where this probably has a bigger impact is just that this confirmation process is going to be another public sort of debate and inflection point about what it is that that ICE and the immigration enforcement, sort of the procedures they're doing and all the, sort of, in my perspective, abuses and sort of overstepping in a lot of these ways, that's going to be in the public eye in a very big public way with these hearings. And so I think that that's going to have an impact on us here, I think that if they make the decision to come here, it likely isn't going to be coming from the Secretary of Homeland Security anyway. It's probably coming from somebody else, like maybe Stephen Miller in the administration.
Given some of the backlash, though, to what happened in Minneapolis, is there – I don't know if hope is the right word or expectation that if ICE were to come and do sort of a surge in Phoenix, that it might be a little more organized, a little less chaotic, maybe a little less deadly?
Well, at the very least, the municipal government's going to be more prepared, to sort of – I don't want to say confront, but to sort of – they're more prepared for what is going to happen than I think they were in Minnesota. That's one thing that I think will happen either way. But I don't put – I think that the way that this chaos has unfolded isn't necessarily that there's somebody at the top who's been – telling people to behave this way. I think there's some of that. I think it's more of a lack of control. And so I don't know necessarily that that this change of leadership will change that. I think that hopefully, though, the fact that it has become such a challenge for the Trump administration with people of both political parties and independents who did not expect that this is going to be the way that, you know, his promises were carried out, that – that hopefully that's giving them some pause, that they realize that this is less politically sort of powerful than it would have been, than they, I think, expected it to be.
Well, Christine, it's interesting to Tony's point a little bit. One of the things that's been said about Senator Mullen is that he doesn't really have law enforcement background, and that maybe the thinking in the Trump administration is, you know, we need somebody who can just be a manager, who can sort of organize everything and have a little bit of more sort of, as they say in college sports, institutional control. Is that something that you might be looking for from a new secretary?
Yeah, I think that's right. Again, I think there's broad agreement among the American population that we want a border that's under control. We don't want unrestricted illegal immigration, and that there does need to be adherence to our laws. What they don't want is chaos in carrying that out. And I think somebody that can bring more structure to implementing the policies is going to be ultimately good for everyone.
The thing that I think the reason he was picked is because he's good on TV in a way that Trump likes. I wonder if that might be the reason why Trump wanted him to be in this position, because Noam was certainly not that. I think that she did a very bad job both in the administration, but in her defense of the steps that she took and her defense of the administration. And so, you know, I hope that he's able to do, you know, what Christina's talking about, but I'm concerned that this is more of an optics type move.
I do think good on TV definitely plays into it.
And it helps. There's a good reason for it. Yeah.
I also think being a member of the Senate and having kind of an inside track to confirmation is another benefit.
It would make sense that somebody like a new DHS secretary, especially right now, could potentially have a difficult time being confirmed, if not maybe for the advantage of going before your former colleagues in the Senate.
Your current colleagues.
your current soon-to-be former colleagues
Correct.
In the Senate. Christina, let me stick with you on government transparency. This has been a pretty big issue in the state since the revelations about a residential like a group home kind of a company that had made some contributions to Governor Hobbs, her inaugural fund, and then they got a rate increase. And there's been sort of a back and forth between Republicans in the legislature and Governor Hobbs about what, like, legislatively to do about this. The Senate this week approved a bill from Senator T.J. Shope on transparency. I'm curious, like, having worked in a governor's office, like, would this have dealt with the thing that senators are concerned about?
Yeah, so it was approved in the Senate. It actually was approved on partisan lines, which I think is unfortunate because this is really common sense bill. This is saying that if you have a company who is seeking a grant or a contract from an executive agency, that is an agency that is controlled by the governor's office, they should reveal all of their donations, whether it's to a an inaugural fund or a legal fund or any other fund that has connections to the executive whose branch is making those decisions. So I do think it was very sad that it was on partisan lines. I think the reason for this, as you said, isn't that some donation was made. A $400,000 donation was made. And this was an agency that was seeking an increase from the previous administration and didn't get it there. So it does beg the question of what changed.
Is there a reason to only have something like this apply to the executive branch and not the legislative branch?
So, and this, yes, it's that the legislative branch has no role in determination of grants or contracts. So when you're looking at those, the only legislative or the only branch that has a role is the executive, which is why this is focused on the executive. I understand the governor's office wants to change the story and look at the legislative branch. That is certainly fine to do. It is not a reason to not do this. I also think, you know, the governor served in the legislature for a long time, so she understands legislative timelines and legislative processes. So when you bring up the idea for a bill related to changes on legislative reporting, but you do it after the bill deadline and you do it after agendas that are the last agendas for committee in the legislature, it doesn't really look like a serious proposal. It looks like deflection.
So, Tony, to Christina's point, this was approved in the Senate along party lines. Is there an expectation the governor has vetoed a kind of similar bill last year, an expectation that given all of the coverage of this situation, that if it gets to her again, that she would veto it again?
I don't know. I don't know. I think that, you know, I agree with the governor in the sense that there needs to be more transparency in the entirety of our sort of government structure. And I do think there needs to be more transparency in contracting. I'm someone who's been a big transparency proponent in all. I've been critical of Democrats and Republicans on this. But I do think that even if they're not handling contracts, there needs to be better transparency in the legislative process. You know, and there's even things down there where, like, for example, they do not consider it a public record that you can sort of request a member of the public what people are being paid out as the legislature for their, like, per diems and their salaries after a couple of years. Like, that's the money the government is spending, but they're saying, like, oh, we're not going to release that to the public. So, you know, a political scientist couldn't do, like, a longitudinal study of, like, the way that the system may or may not be abused. But the greater point here is that I do think that this was brought up because of politics, but I also think that transparency is a good thing and that I wish that it was more comprehensive to sort of, you know, we have this opportunity. And if this was put to a vote of the people when it comes to transparency, it's one of those things that would pass by like 90%. Like, people want this kind of thing.
Which almost makes it difficult, it would seem, for those members who voted against it or for the governor to potentially not sign it if it gets to her.
I think
especially in an election year.
I think so. I don't know whether or not this is the kind, you know, this is the kind of thing that would be put in, like, you know, direct mail or that you could actually actionably put into a campaign. But I'm sure that's going to be a part of the thought process as they're making their decision going forward.
I'm not a campaign person, but I totally disagree. I would put money on the fact that you are going to see the Sunshine Acres issue.
I mean,
Sunshine
specifically
Residential,
this legislation.
And alongside of it is going to say the legislature tried to put a stop to it and it was vetoed at least once. Perhaps it'll say twice by then. I also, Tony, don't think it was entirely accurate that per diems aren't available via public record, because I know there have been stories in the newspaper at least the last 2 years showing which legislator collected the most per diem each session. So there is transparency. Should there be more? Perhaps.
Well,
but
I'll
it's not
you,
a black box.
The reason I know is because they've changed the rules and I got rejected from a public records request.
Personal experience.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. It's a recent change by Senator Peterson.
Christina, there was a new Arizona Public Opinion Pulse poll this week on the Arizona governor's race. Of course, the obvious caveat, snapshot in time, is what a poll is. We're still several months out from the primary and even more from the general election. But interestingly, this took into account Karen Taylor Robeson's withdrawal from the governor's race from the primary. It found that Congressman Andy Biggs is leading Congressman David Schweikert in the GOP primary 40% to 19%, with 41% undecided. So undecided is actually winning that race. It also showed that in the general election, Governor Hobbs is leading both Biggs and Schweikert. The closer one is Biggs, and she's up by 5 points. I'm curious what you take away from this.
Well, I guess my biggest takeaway is we're 8 months away from an election, and yeah. I don't buy into polls that are that far out. You know, I think Congressman Biggs has had a pretty solid floor of about that 40% in the primary from the start. I don't expect that to change. There are a lot of undecideds, but I think that primary race is his to lose. In terms of the general again, we're far out. It's going to be very interesting to see. That is what a poll shows now. I think it's important to remember that there are about 320,000 more registered Republicans than Democrats. Mm-hmm. The Republican registration advantage continues to grow. They also have a good ground game that I think might be even better this year when you have organizations like Turning Points that has a real vested interest in going out. And I think they might describe it as win-win for Charlie. So I don't think that the ground game and the registration advantage can be counted out. On the other side of that, it is always challenging for a party that is the party in power in D.C. to win in these midterm elections. Now, it can be done. Remember, in 2018, President Trump was in the White House and Governor Ducey did win his reelection by even mm-hmm. larger margins than he won in 2014. So we've got 8 months. We've got a lot of time to go.
Do you buy into the conventional wisdom, Christina, that Andy Biggs is the candidate who sort of won the most from or gained the most from Karen Taylor Robeson dropping out? Or is it maybe too soon to say?
I think it's too soon to say. He's stayed right around that 40% regardless of what the poll is. I didn't see a lot of movement toward that. You certainly saw Congressman Schweikert pick up some from that KTR withdrawal. But as you say, we've got 41% undecided. And I think most of the folks who had been in the Karen Taylor Robeson camp are waiting to see where they're going to go.
Tony, what are your takeaways from this?
You know, I think the 41% undecided is a big number in a race where there hasn't really been any paid communications of a negative nature about any of the candidates. I know that Robeson spent a decent amount of money trying to raise her profile while she was running. And so, you know, if there's one thing about Schweikert that certainly Democrats know and, you know, and some of his Republican primary opponents know, is Schweikert is somebody who will fight hard. Or as some might say, fight dirty. And I think that one of the things that if he is going to make a run at this, he's going to have to go after Biggs in a way that maybe will turn off some Republican primary voters. But that stuff does work. And in recent elections, when there was this sort of a dynamic where there was a more, sort of super hard MAGA candidate, which Biggs is, versus a more sort of, longer – sort of a more traditional Republican, even though, of course, they're both, in my opinion, very conservative. The sort of more conservative candidate who's less on the MAGA side of things has been reluctant to go after the MAGA candidate. Hmm. And so, you know, you saw that in the Secretary of State's race where, you know, Mark Fincham won that primary when there was plenty of things that they could have attacked him on that would have probably made him lose that primary. And so that's the big question is that is Schweikert really in this race? If he is he going to go after Biggs? I think that he probably will. And then I think that if that type of turmoil is happening in the primary, that is going to further help Governor Hobbs in the general election.
Yeah, if you're Governor Hobbs, how hard are you rooting for Schweikert to go after Biggs?
I think you're probably rooting for them to go after each other. I've never been someone who bought that one of any of the three candidates was better than the other candidates. I know I've been pretty vocal about that.
Okay.
I think that's just not how voters are making up their minds in these kind of elections right now. But you want there to be a messy fight on the other side when you're in a race, especially when there are candidates like Biggs and Schweikert who both have very easy to attack sort of history, whether it's the ethics stuff with Schweikert or whether it's some of the sort of very unpopular votes that Biggs has taken. It's great if someone else is spending the money to get that stuff in front of the public before you have to.
Christina, will it matter that the two candidates on the Republican side, in terms of whether they go after each other, that they've been colleagues for some number of years in Congress? Does that matter at all?
You know, I think in politics, you're often going after one of your colleagues in an election, whether it's on the Republican side or the Democrat side. And at some point, an attack is going to happen from one of them. That is just the nature of how elections work. So I do expect that if Congressman Schweikert wants to make up ground in this race, he is going to have to attack.
Okay. Christina, let me ask you about a bill that went through the Senate this week. It dealt with sort of design aesthetics, both inside a home and outside the home. And the legislature basically said to cities, you can, if this bill becomes law, you can no longer dictate, you know, if a home has a fence outside or what the you know, what the material on the roof can be, things like that. Cities are very much not in favor of this. This is an issue that has been coming up at the legislature for the past several years. Do you get the sense that there's the momentum this year to take it farther than it's been in past years?
You know, this presents an interesting question and one that doesn't break on your traditional party lines. If you look at the vote, it did eke by a few votes, but it wasn't overwhelmingly one party or the other. Both parties split pretty evenly down the middle. And it really puts two conflicting real issues up against each other. The proponents of this bill are talking about something that's true, and that's the growing price of the increasing price of housing, the increasing age at which somebody is able to afford their first house, and they're looking at how can we drive down these prices. So they want to prohibit the cities from, you know, requiring certain amenities like a park or something like that that would require upkeep and ultimately drive up the cost of housing. On the other side, you have individuals who've already bought their house, and they don't want things that are going to drive down the cost of their investment. And you have people who like the style of community that they live in. They like the separation between houses, et cetera. And so it will be interesting to see how this one plays out. Historically, the governor has tended to lean on the side of the cities, but I'm not sure how it will go in this one.
Yeah, Tony, these housing bills we've seen over the last few years have been really interesting, to Christina's point that most of the time, much of the time, there is both bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition. They don't really break down along partisan lines. I wonder if, like, at this point, is there a compromise to be had? I mean, they haven't come up with one yet between the legislature and the cities. Is there a compromise to be had here?
I think there could be, but I don't think that there's any sort of meaningful, legitimate conversation happening between the legislature and the cities on this. I think that one of the things that's happening is, like, this type of bill has been proposed in the past several times. This time they've attached it more to the cost of housing. Previously it was just sort of, you know, really just, about what cities have the authority to do and what cities don't have the authority to do. I think the reason why the cities and cities should be, if the legislature's not coming to the table, they should be trying very hard to get them to the table to have this conversation, is because the pressures on housing costs are driving almost the entire political conversation in our state, I think, in a huge way. And if the cities don't become a part of that solution, people are going to be able to – the legislature are either going to solve it for them, or they're going to use the pressure to sort of get other things passed that they, you know, that may or may not, you know, create incremental or real change. And so there needs to be some sort of a legitimate, you know, effort, because this is a major problem that doesn't just affect, you know, when it comes to sort of like whether a young person can buy a home. Like, that's a big part of it. But this is also like an economic development problem, because a lot of companies, when they're deciding whether or not they're going to expand or move to a state, which has been a big part of our economic growth over the past several years, the cost of housing is a big part of the way they're making their decision. They want to know whether or not it's going to be affordable for their employees. And so this is a huge problem. And also, when things are expensive for people, folks start moving to other states. And so they need to find a solution to this. I don't know whether or not this will actually lower the cost of housing, but I think it's a symptom of the huge pressure to actually do something to fix this problem.
Well, and Christina, to Tony's point, that there's also sort of a political aspect here where affordability seems to be one of the key phrases we keep hearing leading up to the midterm elections.
Nationally and locally, affordability is a real issue. And I think both sides want to say that there's something that they're working on this. And a lot of the people in the legislature have children that have reached adulthood, and they're seeing their own children struggle with this. And Tony's right. This is a workforce housing issue, but it's also an issue of a lot of times when people can't afford a house, they don't feel like they're ready to start a family.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so you have concerns about, you know, decreased birth rate. And is this weighing into that as well?
Interesting. All right, guys, we'll have to leave it there. Christina Corrieri, Tony Conti, thanks to you both for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, in his one-man show, a storyteller embodies characters from his youth to trace his path to fatherhood.
But first, It's been nearly 3 years since Arizona's state government was rocked by a massive Medicaid fraud scandal that cost an unprecedented $2.5 billion and left countless indigenous people without the help they need. And now, after criminal investigations, lawsuits, policy changes, and more, our next guest reports the fraud continues. Jasmine Demers is an investigative reporter for the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, and our co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
It's been nearly 3 years now since the state sort of acknowledged that this fraud was happening, and they say that the crisis has really stabilized and that investigations have dropped significantly, but that there are still recruitment tactics going on and that the billing practices that were happening before are still happening, just at a smaller scale. So according to state data, those fraud investigations have dropped from about 1,400 at the peak of the fraud in 2023 to around 270 cases as of August of last year. But that's still a significant amount for the people who are being harmed. And that's still hundreds of cases more than it was before the fraud started prior to 2019.
Right. Okay. So back up, Jasmine, for a moment and just remind us how these fraud schemes worked. Like, you've basically got sham providers luring patients into treatment programs, mostly Native Americans, and then billing the state's Medicaid arm for it and for services they never provided.
Yes, absolutely. So this was starting in around 2019, and it was hundreds of behavioral health providers who were sober living home operators that began exploiting gaps in the system. And that was particularly within the American Indian Health Program. So recruiters would specifically target Native Americans struggling with substance use, and they would promise them treatment and housing and transportation. But in many cases, those services either weren't being provided or were extremely minimal. And at the same time, providers were billing Medicaid for intensive behavioral health services that often did not happen. So because of weak oversight and billing controls at the time, the system paid out billions of dollars before the fraud was actually fully recognized in 2023.
Right, right. And people died because of this. And like you said, it's to the tune of billions of dollars. There was swift reaction when this all came to light a few years ago, as you're pointing out, a criminal investigation by the attorney general in the state, a class action lawsuit is underway from the victims. There have been a series of reforms announced at the state level. What does the state have to say about the fact that this is still going on, even though all of these things have happened?
Right now, there's lots of oversight hearings going on. So since August, there's been about four of these oversight hearings at the state legislature under the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. And it was at one of these hearings where a senior leader at Access pointed out that, you know, we're not completely out of the woods. We are still being billed for fraudulent services. We know that recruitment is still happening. So they recognized that during those committee hearings. But then in responses to our newsroom via the public information officer, they sort of glossed over that and basically said that the fraud that proliferated during a previous administration had effectively ended. But based on the numbers and based on what was said during some of these committee hearings, we know that that's not true.
So at the same time, you've got this other kind of problem, this almost mirrored problem, which is that real providers who, you know, are doing real work for this community say they can't get paid out now for their legitimate services.
Yeah, absolutely. So the state's crackdown, which, you know, at the time they were sort of applauded for, they shut down a bunch of facilities, suspended a ton of providers, and tried to stop the fraud in that way. But that sort of led to a lot of other problems. There were a lot of legitimate treatment providers who say that they have been really mixed up in the fraud crackdown. They have been suspended themselves. They've experienced delays in reimbursements. And a lot of these providers say that it's forced them to reduce services or treat patients without being paid altogether. And that's really concerning because it creates this sort of cycle, right? it's making it so that those people can't get the support and help that they need. So it's really creating an access of care issue on top of sort of re-traumatizing a community that has already been traumatized by the fraud itself.
Let me ask you lastly, Jasmine, about the attempts from state lawmakers, and there are many, to try to fix these issues. As you mentioned, there have been hearings on this, state lawmakers trying to get to the bottom of how to address these systemic issues. What are some of the legislative proposals on the table?
Yeah, so after they've held these oversight hearings, lawmakers, and particularly Senator Corinne Werner, has come forward with several bills. I think there's 8 or 9 of them aimed at restructuring how our state oversees behavioral health care. One of the biggest proposals would be to shift the administration of the American Indian Health Program to an outside managed care organization.
Right.
Access would technically still have oversight power over that, but the day-to-day administrative work would be left to a managed care organization. And that would be a very significant shift. Other states in the country have done this. There's not very many that have done it, but it's been done. This obviously requires some significant input from tribal communities as well as state leaders. So, you know, things could definitely change as they debate this bill this session, but it would be a pretty significant shift.
And what has the state had to say about proposals like that? Are they commenting?
The state has told me that they were sent the bill ahead of its announcement at the Senate committee hearing. Mm-hmm. However, they have concerns. They say that it would cost quite a bit to implement. And then they have concerns about the timeline of the implementation of the bill. So this would be an emergency measure, as it's written now, at least. So Access would have a very limited amount of time to get feedback from the federal Medicaid agency as well as tribal partners. So I think that's their biggest concern right now. It doesn't seem like they're super on board with it.
Okay. We'll leave it there for now. Lots to watch for on this front. That is Jasmine Demers, investigative reporter for the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, joining us. Jasmine, thank you for coming on the show. Appreciate your reporting here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. In his new one-man show, comedian and storyteller Rick Herrera traces the arc of his life from growing up without the presence of his father to becoming a father. It's a long and arduous journey, and the show doesn't shy away from the scariest and most confusing moments. But the title of the show, Let's Laugh a Little, contains a clue about Herrera's approach. Herrera is performing the piece tomorrow night at Changing Hands in Phoenix, and I caught up with him recently about how he arrived at the impulse to share a story like this. He told me a lot of it has to do with how he was raised.
Every time that I share something to my mom or to my sister, the next day, like, everybody in the house or family and friends would knew about my business. I'm like, my mom would try to chalk it up like, I didn't say anything. I'm like, that's odd, because they have very specific details that I told you the other day. So that was like the beginning of, like, you know, can I really even trust my own family and friends, like, to share what I really, really feel?
Right.
But I guess, you know, that was the culture. That's what they was brought up to as well. Like, there's no secrets here.
Yeah.
What you are going through, we either went through it too, and now the lady at the grocery store is going to know too, like, for whatever reason.
Right.
Like, why does she have to know that? Like,
right.
So, yeah, I was definitely wanted that safe space.
Yeah.
I think it would have helped out even more, and I still would have went to therapy down the road.
Well, I'm glad you brought up therapy and your mom, because your mom plays a big role in the show.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just talk about her. You take her on as a mm-hmm. character. We meet her, mm-hmm. you know, as a character that you are performing.
Mm-hmm.
And you talk about how, because your dad was not really around mm-hmm. for much of your childhood, I think at one point she says, I'm your father mm-hmm. and I'm your mother.
Yeah.
And you talk about all the responsibilities that she was kind of saddled with because of this. And at one point, she starts going to therapy.
Yes.
And I'm curious what that modeled for you.
Yeah, I noticed when my mom went to therapy that on the outside, I just knew she was talking to someone, right? And then as I got older, I was like, oh, this is a therapist, right? But the automatically, the first thing I noticed that she felt, I noticed she felt lighter. Maybe something happened with my dad or my sister, and I felt I would feel this cloud. And then every month around the time when she went to the therapist, she came back and I noticed she bought me candy. Like when she went to this lady, she bought me, you know, some toys. I'm like, can I see this lady too? Because whatever she's doing, I want to give her a hug. So, yeah, it showed me that the light of talking to someone and maybe, hey, maybe I could get that too somehow when I'm older. What is this, you know?
Well, so let me ask you about that, because now here you are narrating your most personal experiences to audiences. Do you see a connection between those things?
Oh, absolutely. The me writing and writing this show is a mirror to myself. I can't run from it. Where from a therapist, I can lie, right? I can say, yeah, you know, I was all right with that. But if I go in front of a mirror and say, yeah, I'm all right with that, the mirror is showing me another side of me. Is like, why are you lying? I don't like when I lie to myself. So no, if I do that, now I'm lying to a group of people. And if I'm lying, now that lie is traveling to you. And now without you even knowing, the audience is like, well, it's okay to lie to myself. That's messed up. It's this plague that I'm and disease that I'm passing on.
One of the things I find really interesting about the way you've structured the show is that you begin, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff at the beginning, but one of the big things you're doing is you introduce us to these characters from your neighborhood when you were growing up. And they're these big kind of cartoonish characters. There's a kind of a sidewalk preacher.
Yeah, Mr.
Who's
Hallelujah.
There. Yeah, Mr. Hallelujah. That's right. And I don't think we can say his nickname on the radio, but there's the guy, there's like a thief who lives in your building. He's like kind of a charmer.
Mr. Hydra Stuff James.
Yes, there we go. And it just sketches a world instantly for us so that we're kind of with you. But it's also funny. And it makes it clear that you have a buoyant relationship with these things, which in some cases I'm sure were not fun to live through. And so you start with comedy. And then from there, we segue into some of the darker elements of the story. As we've alluded to, your relationship with your father. Eventually, you talk about a miscarriage that you and your wife went through. Talk about that structure.
I always have to build the stage. Where did I grow up at? You know, who were the people around me that in this community that played a role in my life, where at the time maybe it was annoying or challenging, but they were funny people. So I always, in everything that I do in storytelling, I like to build a scene and find the humor in that and honestly honor these people. And by honoring them, I'm also honoring myself and keeping their story alive.
A big part of the narrative in the show is your journey to being a husband and your journey to being a father. You talk about the process of meeting the woman who's now your wife.
Yes.
And you talk about how in order to get to a place where you were ready to get married to her, you had to leave behind your more adventurous ways in your youth. Your wife is also the director of the show. So tell me about that collaboration.
Well, first and foremost, before she became my wife, she was an artist as well. I was an artist. I mean, we still are artists, but we both met in the community of being performers. She knew of my one-man shows before we tied the knot, right? So here we are now. I think she knew that eventually I will talk about certain things that happened because it just comes second nature. This is how I met this man, right? I told her I would never tell you not to share anything or your truth in this in any show, because if I do that, now I'm hindering and I'm putting you in a corner with your creativity. I would never do that to any artist. So after setting that up, right, because it started off in friendship, then marriage, there wasn't really a conversation of like, don't share that. It was like, how are you going to share that?
Can you think of any moments where there was something that you were maybe nervous about including or or wanted to include, and through your collaboration with her that changed?
One of the toughest things that I had to talk about in the show was the miscarriage. When it happened, it was even tough to face it and talk to her about it, right? Because there was things that I saw in that room when I talked about on the show that no one could have prepared me for. Like, I knew it was a possibility, but women are prepared more of like, this is life, this could happen. And then seeing her moving on faster than what I was, because she was already programmed since, you know, young, hey, this is the life and the cycles of women. And guys, we didn't have to worry about that. Like, we was taught wear a condom and good luck. I know where my world, you know, it wasn't like, hey, you also got to be concerned if, and this could be a possibility. And then if you're around a community of people that you don't hear vocally of like, hey, my wife had a miscarriage. With dudes, it's like all my friends that had a child, they had it the first go around. I never heard anything else about that. So when the miscarriage happened, it was tough for me to talk about because I didn't want to relive it. I went back to my old ways of like, I don't feel safe to talk about it. I'm going to just bundle it up inside. And talking about this in this show was tough because I feel like even the audience is there listening and watching and they're not judging. But it was a silence of don't want to relive, because it's the same silence that I remembered being in the situation when it was actually happening.
So let me make sure I understand that. You're saying that what was difficult for you in talking about it is you could feel the audience get quiet.
It's silent.
Yeah.
It's the same silent that I heard when it was actually happening in the moment. No one was talking. I saw the blood. I saw all those things. And so I'm not afraid of silence per se because I love it. But in this particular moment, it's a trigger. It's like, I remember that sound. I was like, I don't want to be in this room. So that was like the toughest. And even now I get a little emotional talking about it now, but it's fine. Because I find healing by talking about it. But then there's men that text me, friends, hey, I want to thank you for sharing that. Because when my wife had a miscarriage, I had to go work the next day. And I didn't have a moment to even grieve or help her grieve. Thank you for sharing that.
Did your wife help you push through that discomfort of putting it in the show?
I didn't present that to her. I'm sharing it with you. And the show, it's there, but I'm going deeper with you. And I guess she's hearing it too for the first time. But I don't think I ever shared that deeply with her, why that was so tough, even like the silence. So I didn't even give her an opportunity to be like, help me get through this. I just allowed time and my writing to help me get through it. Because when there was moments where I feel like I was writing and I felt like, ooh, why are you going, ooh? This is how I talk to myself, by the way. You're getting a glimpse. I'll tell myself, why are you feeling ooh like that? Why are you clenching up? I don't want to talk about it. Yeah, you should. That's why. If you're feeling that, there's a reason why you're feeling that. You got to talk about it. And then it's a reminder. And if you're feeling that, what do you think the audience is going to feel?
Well, I have been speaking with Rick Wind Herrera. He's an actor, a writer, and a comedian. And we've been talking about his solo show, Let's Laugh a Little, which will be at Changing Hands in Phoenix on March 7th. Rick, thank you for this conversation.
No, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I could be here all day. You want to do a part two?
All right, that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Remember, you can sign up, and you probably should sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can sign up at theshow.kjzz.org. While you're online, don't forget to follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show.
The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, and Claire Lawton is our newsletter editor. Chad Snow is our news director. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, hope you have a fantastic weekend, and we'll talk to you again on Monday morning.